Chapter 18, Justice, by Nicole Hannah Jones. Origin stories function, to a degree, as myths designed to create a shared sense of history and purpose. Nations simplify these narratives in order to unify and glorify, and these origin stories serve to illuminate how a society wants to see itself and how it doesn't. The origin story of the United States that we tell ourselves through textbooks and films, monuments and museums, public speeches and public histories, the one that most defines our national identity, portrays an intrepid, freedom-loving people who rebelled against an oppressive monarchy, won their independence, tamed the West, advanced an exceptional nation based on the radical ideals of self-governance and equality, and heroically fought a civil war to end slavery and preserve that nation. This mythology has positioned, almost exclusively, white Americans as the architects and champions of democracy. And because of this, some have believed that white people should disproportionately reap the benefits of this democracy. But as this book has shown, a truer origin story requires us to place Black Americans prominently in the role of democracy's defenders and perfecters. It is Black Americans who have struggled and fought when many white Americans were willing to abandon the charge that all men are created equal to make those words real. It is Black Americans who have consistently made the case, even when they were utterly disenfranchised and forced out of the political process, that all citizens deserve equal access to the benefits of a country founded on a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. The efforts of Black Americans to seek freedom through resistance and rebellion against violations of their rights have always been one of this nation's defining traditions. But the country has rarely seen it that way, because for Black Americans, the freedom struggle has been a centuries-long fight against their own fellow Americans and against the very government intended to uphold the rights of its citizens. Though we are seldom taught this fact, time after time throughout our history, the most ardent, courageous, and consistent freedom fighters within this country have been Black Americans. We see it in the 1739 Stonewall Rebellion, when about 20 Black men in South Carolina launched the largest revolt of enslaved people in the British mainland colonies before the American Revolution. We see it in Gabriel, who in 1800 conspired to lead an insurrection of the enslaved against their white enslavers, and whose failed plot included a plan to claim the rhetoric of white revolutionaries by purchasing a piece of silk for a flag on which to write the motto, "Death or Liberty." We see it in David Walker, a free Black man who published his Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World in 1829, calling on enslaved people to rise up and liberate themselves, as white Americans had done, through violence if necessary. He wrote, "I speak, Americans, for your good. We must and shall be free, I say, in spite of you. You may do your best to keep us in wretchedness and misery to enrich you and your children, but God will deliver us from under you, and woe, woe will be to you if we have to obtain our freedom by fighting." These words demanding freedom proved so powerful that white Southerners banned the pamphlet. Walker was found dead a few months later. We see it in Ida B. Wells, who with her fiery pen condemned lynching and violent and legal efforts by white Southerners to deny newly freed Black Americans the vote, writing, "The reproach and disgrace of the 20th century is that the whole of the American people have permitted a part to nullify this glorious achievement and make the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution playthings, a mockery and a byword, an absolute dead letter in the Constitution of the United States. With no sacredness of the ballot, there can be no sacredness of human life itself. For if the strong can take the weak man's ballot, when it suits his purpose to do so, he will take his life also. We see it in Fannie Lou Hamer, a black woman in Mississippi, the most oppressive apartheid state in America, thrown off her land and beaten repeatedly for demanding the right to vote, who in 1964 said, "Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hooks because our lives be threatened daily, because we want to live as decent human beings in America?" We see it in Latosha Brown, who co-founded Black Voters Matter and spent 2020 successfully organizing black voters across the South against voter suppression efforts in order to try to rescue this democracy, saying, "The Constitution says we the people and that the power is supposed to go to the people. How do we really deal with racism and sexism and all those other things that keep us from tapping into the brilliance and the power of the people that are in this country? And how do we form this more perfect union so that literally we can get life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?" In this centuries-long tradition of protest, there have been hundreds of uprisings in segregated black communities. In the last century, some have produced substantive change. After the assassination of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, rebellions erupted in more than 100 cities, and fear that the country teetered on the brink of civil war broke the congressional deadlock over the Fair Housing Act. The bill, which prohibited housing discrimination on the basis of race, gender, or religion, among other categories, made it illegal to deny people housing simply because they descended from those who had been enslaved. Though King had fought hard for the bill, white congressional representatives from the North had joined with representatives from the South to block its passage. Many considered the proposed law the Northern Civil Rights Bill because racial segregation in the North had largely been accomplished through housing discrimination. 7 days after King's death, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the act into law from the smoldering Capitol, which remained under the protection of the National Guard. Just weeks before King's assassination, Johnson's Kerner Commission, which he had created to study the root causes of the many black rebellions that had swept through Detroit, Newark, and cities across the nation in the mid-1960s, had issued its report, which recommended a national effort to dismantle segregation and structural racism across American institutions. It was shelved by the president, like so many similar reports, and instead, white Americans voted in a law and order president, Richard Nixon. This sort of backlash has been the typical response to black resistance. The following decades brought increased police militarization, more law enforcement spending, and mass incarceration of black Americans. And despite continued protests, organizing, and uprisings in black communities in response to police or vigilante white violence, those movements seldom prodded enough non-black people, or more important, enough politicians, into pushing for and enacting substantial change. In 2020, something changed. The collective witnessing of what must be described without hyperbole as a modern-day lynching by an agent of the state propelled a global protest that would become the largest movement for civil rights in American history. Even as the nature of George Floyd's death shocked us, a white law enforcement officer taking part in the extrajudicial killing of a black person, nonchalantly pressing the life out of him in plain view of more than a dozen onlookers, it also reminded us that we had not banished this barbaric part of our history. Yet unlike so many times in the past, in which black people mostly marched and protested alone to demand recognition of their full humanity and citizenship, in 2020, a multiracial and multigenerational protest army braved a pandemic and took to the streets. The protesters gathered in all 50 states, in places big and small, from heavily black big cities to small, almost entirely white towns. At first, the changes wrought by those protests seemed to come shockingly swift. The weeks of demonstrations finally moved lawmakers in some places to ban chokeholds by police officers, to consider stripping law enforcement of the qualified immunity that has made it almost impossible to hold responsible officers who kill, and to discuss shifting significant parts of ballooning police budgets into funding for social services. Soon, the outrage over police violence morphed into something broader. Protesters who understood that police officers are simply the enforcement mechanism of a vastly unequal society maintained by historic and systemic racism took a stand against monuments to enslavers and bigots from Virginia to Philadelphia to Minneapolis and New Mexico, defacing or snatching down statues and pushing local and state politicians to locate the moral courage to realize that they indeed did have the power to purge from public spaces icons to white supremacy. A rainbow coalition of white, black, Latino, Asian, and indigenous voters swept Trump out of office and helped Democrats retake the U.S. Senate while also electing Kamala Harris as the first black, the first Asian, and the first female vice president in the history of this country. Those voters also managed to push Joe Biden, a man whose decades-long political career epitomized the moderate Democrat, to the left. And from the first days of his presidency, he incorporated racial justice into his rhetoric. George Floyd, a father, a brother, a regular man who just wanted to live a life free of struggle, did not choose to be a martyr to racial justice. This nation had no right to choose that for him. Yet his death helped spawn an awareness of racial suffering and a willingness to excavate how this nation's racist past deforms our present that I had never seen before in my lifetime. But those heady days of promise soon gave way to the grim reality that the racist systems that have undergirded our society for 400 years do not collapse after a few months of protest. The number of voters supporting Trump, a white nationalist president, increased when he ran for a second term. And when Trump lost, his supporters led an insurrection in the nation's capital, seeking, just as white mobs had done repeatedly during Reconstruction, to overturn and delegitimize an election won by a multiracial coalition of voters. Then, in response to well-organized Black, Latino, and Indigenous voters helping turn heavily Republican states such as Georgia and Arizona blue, Republicans began a coordinated effort to introduce and pass hundreds of bills that would make it harder for millions of Americans to vote. Some have called these efforts, which came not even a year after the death of the civil rights icon John Lewis, who in the 1960s nearly lost his life to secure voting rights for Black Americans, the worst attacks on voting in more than 50 years. And just as a jury found Derek Chauvin guilty on all three counts against him, including two of murder, the rarest of outcomes, news broke of another police killing, and another, and another. It is unclear what substantial and transformative change will come from the reckoning that began in 2020, or, distressingly, if whatever changes occur will lead to more freedom and equality, or less. But by reading to the end of this book, you have gained a sense of the stark reality we must confront. Even if we pass wide-ranging policing and voting reforms, on their own, these cannot bring justice to America. Resolving the policing issue would save precious Black lives and help preserve the dignity Black Americans still must fight for. It would make Black Americans safer and dismantle a tool of social control with a lineage that stretches back to slavery. But it would leave wholly intact the primary culprit of Black suffering today. If we seek to truly make this a transformative moment, if we are indeed serious about creating a more just society, we must go much further than that. We must get to the root of it. 50 years after the bloody and brutally repressed protests and freedom struggles of Black Americans brought about the end of legal discrimination in this country, so much of what makes Black lives hard, what takes Black lives earlier, what causes Black Americans to be vulnerable to the type of surveillance and policing that killed Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, what steals opportunities, is the lack of wealth that has been a defining feature of Black life since the end of slavery. Wealth, not simply securing equal rights, is a means to security in America. Wealth, assets, and investments minus debt, is what enables you to buy a home in a safer neighborhood with better amenities and better funded schools. It is what enables you to send your children to college without saddling them with tens of thousands of dollars of debt and what provides money for a down payment on a house. It is what prevents family emergencies or unexpected job losses from turning into catastrophes that leave you homeless and destitute. It is what ensures what every parent wants, that your children will have fewer struggles than you did. Wealth is security and peace of mind. It's not incidental that wealthier people are healthier and live longer. Wealth is, as a 2019 Yale study titled "The Misperception of Racial Economic Inequality" states, the most consequential index of economic well-being for most Americans. But wealth is not something most people create solely by themselves. It is accumulated across generations. While unchecked discrimination still plays a significant role in circumscribing opportunities for Black Americans, it is white Americans' centuries-long economic head start that most effectively maintains racial caste today. As soon as laws began to ban racial discrimination against Black Americans, white Americans created so-called race-neutral means of maintaining political and economic power. In a country where Black people have been kept disproportionately poor and prevented from building wealth, rules and policies involving money can be nearly as effective for maintaining the color line as legal segregation and disenfranchisement. For example, in the late 1800s, soon after the 15th Amendment granted Black men the right to vote, white politicians in many states, understanding that recently freed Black Americans were of course impoverished, implemented poll taxes. And so when the civil rights movement made explicit discrimination illegal, white Americans understood that they did not have to maintain laws forcing segregated housing in schools if, using their intergenerational wealth and higher incomes, they could simply buy their way into expensive enclaves with exclusive public schools that are out of the price range of most Black Americans. This has worked with impressive efficiency. Today, Black Americans remain the most segregated group of people in America and are 5 times as likely as white Americans to live in high poverty neighborhoods. Not even high earnings inoculate Black people against racialized disadvantage. Black families earning $75,000 or more a year live in poorer neighborhoods than white Americans earning less than $40,000 a year, according to research by John Logan, a Brown University sociologist. Another study by the Stanford sociologist Sean Reardon and his colleagues shows that the average Black family earning $100,000 a year lives in a neighborhood with an average annual income of $54,000. Black Americans with high incomes are still Black. They face discrimination across American life. But it is because their families have not been able to build wealth that they are often unable to come up with a down payment to buy in more affluent neighborhoods, while white Americans with lower incomes often use familial wealth to do so. The difference between the lived experience of Black Americans and white Americans when it comes to wealth, along the entire spectrum of income from the poorest to the richest, can be described as nothing other than a chasm. According to research published in 2020 by scholars at Duke University and Northwestern University, the average Black family with children holds just 1 cent of wealth for every dollar held by the average white family with children. As President Lyndon Johnson, architect of the Great Society, explained in a 1965 speech titled To Fulfill These Rights, Negro poverty is not white poverty. These differences are not racial differences. They are solely and simply the consequence of ancient brutality, past injustice, and present prejudice. They are anguishing to observe. For the Negro, they are a constant reminder of oppression. For the white, they are a constant reminder of guilt. But they must be faced, and they must be dealt with, and they must be overcome. If we are ever to reach a time when the only difference between Negroes and whites is the color of their skin. We sometimes forget, and I would argue it is an intentional forgetting, that the racism we are fighting today was originally conjured to justify working unfree black people, often until death, to generate extravagant riches for European colonial powers, the white planter class, and the ancillary white people, from Midwestern farmers to bankers to sailors to textile workers who earned their living and built their wealth from that free black labor and the products that labor produced. The prosperity of this country is inextricably linked with the forced labor of the ancestors of more than 30 million black Americans, just as it is linked to the stolen land of the country's indigenous people. Though our high school history books seldom make this plain, slavery and the 100-year period of racial apartheid and racial terrorism known as Jim Crow were, above all else, systems of economic exploitation. To borrow a phrase from Ta-Nehisi Coates, racism is the child of economic profiteering, not the father. Innumerable legal efforts to strip black people of their humanity existed to justify the extraction of profit. Beginning in the 1660s, white officials ensured that all children born to enslaved women would also be enslaved for life and would not belong to their mothers, but to the white men who owned their mothers. These officials passed laws dictating that the child's status would follow that of the mother, not the father, upending European norms and guaranteeing that the children of enslaved women who were raped or sexually coerced by white men would be born enslaved, not free as they would be if their status followed their father's. It meant that profit for white people could be made from black women's wombs. Laws determining that enslaved people, just like animals, had no recognized kinship ties ensured that human beings could be bought and sold at will to pay debts, buy more acres, or save storied universities like Georgetown from closing. Laws barred enslaved people from making wills or owning property, distinguishing black people in America from every other group on these shores, and assuring that nearly everything of value black people managed to accrue would add to the wealth of those who enslaved them. At the time of the Civil War, the value of enslaved human beings held as property added up to more than all of this nation's railroads and factories combined. And yet, enslaved people saw not a dime of this wealth. They owned nothing and were owed nothing from all that had been built from their toil. Freed people, during and after slavery, tried to compel the government to provide restitution for slavery, to provide, at the very least, a pension for those who, along with generations of their ancestors, had spent their entire lives toiling for no pay. They filed lawsuits. They organized to lobby politicians, and every effort failed. The closest this country ever came to delivering on reparations was in the immediate aftermath of slavery's demise, during a moment that offered this nation the chance for redemption. Out of the ashes of sectarian strife, we could have birthed a new country, one that recognized the humanity and natural rights of those who had helped forge this nation, one that attempted to atone and provide redress for the unspeakable atrocities committed against black people in the name of profit. We could have finally, 100 years after the American Revolution, embraced its founding ideals. And oh, so briefly, during the period known as Reconstruction, we moved toward that goal. The historian Eric Foner refers to these 12 years after the Civil War as this nation's second founding, because it is here that America began to redeem the grave sin of slavery. Congress passed amendments abolishing human bondage, enshrining equal protection before the law in the Constitution, and guaranteeing Black men the right to vote. This nation witnessed its first period of biracial governance as the formerly enslaved were elected to public offices at all levels of government. Millions of Black people, liberated with not a cent to their names, desperately wanted property so they could work, support themselves, and be left alone. They understood that land in this country has always meant wealth and, more important, independence. Black people implored federal officials to grant the land confiscated from enslavers who had taken up arms against their own country to those who had worked it for generations. They were asking, as the historian Robin D.G. Kelly puts it, to inherit the earth they had turned into wealth for idle white people. And for a fleeting moment, a few white men listened to the pleas of Black people who had fought for the Union and helped deliver its victory. In January 1865, as the Civil War raged towards its final battle, 20 Black leaders, most of whom were ministers who had been born into slavery, gathered in Savannah, Georgia, for a meeting with Secretary of War Edwin Stanton and Union General William Tecumseh Sherman. During his famed March to the Sea through Georgia a couple months earlier, Sherman had largely treated as a nuisance the estimated 10,000 poor and desperate people who'd abandoned their enslavers and begun to follow behind his troops. Many who had ran to the Union lines seeking freedom and protection had instead died of starvation and sickness. But a turning point came after a Union brigadier general serving under Sherman ordered his troops to remove a pontoon bridge from Ebenezer Creek before the Black refugees trailing his unit could cross. Confederate scouts began shooting at the refugees, and many ran into the icy river and drowned. Others were killed in the stampede, and some were likely shot to death. The Confederates re-enslaved those who did not manage to make it across the creek. The tragedy evoked widespread outrage and condemnation in the North and alarmed the administration in Washington. In response, Stanton traveled to Savannah and called a meeting between Sherman and the Black leaders to pose what at the time was a radical question for white Americans to ask Black ones. What do you want for your own people? The Black delegation's leader, Reverend Garrison Frazier, a 67-year-old man who'd spent 59 years in bondage before purchasing his wife's and his own freedom 8 years earlier, asked for the same thing most white Americans wanted. Slavery is receiving by irresistible power the work of another man and not by his consent. The freedom, as I understand it, promised by the Emancipation Proclamation is taking us from under the yoke of bondage and placing us where we could reap the fruit of our own labor, take care of ourselves, and assist the government in maintaining our freedom. The key to that, Frazier said, was land. The way we can best take care of ourselves is to have land and turn it and till it by our own labor. That is, by the labor of the women and children and old men, and we can soon maintain ourselves and have something to spare. We want to be placed on land until we are able to buy it and make it our own. Remarkably, with millions of Black Americans just weeks past being released from generational slavery, they did not seek a government handout, even though getting land that they'd worked in order to produce wealth for others could hardly be considered one. They simply asked for land to work until they could earn enough money to purchase it. 4 days later, Sherman issued Special Field Order 15, providing for the distribution of hundreds of thousands of acres of former Confederate land in 40-acre tracts to newly freed people along coastal South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. This became known as 40 Acres and a Mule. Sherman was neither a humanitarian reformer nor a man with any particular concern for blacks, Eric Foner writes in his groundbreaking book, Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution. Instead of seeing Field Order 15 as a blueprint for the transformation of Southern society, he viewed it mainly as a way of relieving the immediate pressure caused by the large number of impoverished blacks following his army. And yet, Foner writes, the prospect beckoned of a transformation of Southern society more radical even than the end of slavery. One of the ministers at the meeting, Ulysses L. Houston, organized 1,000 black residents and claimed land in Skidaway Island, Georgia, where they founded a self-governing black community. Some 40,000 freed people staked their claim to 400,000 acres of Sherman land in a region, Foner writes, that had spawned one of the wealthiest segments of the planter class. President Abraham Lincoln, in his second inaugural address on April 10, 1865, given the day after the final major battle of the Civil War, asked his fellow Americans to consider what the nation owed the enslaved. Speaking of the Union and the Confederacy, Lincoln said, "Neither party expected for the war the magnitude or the duration which it has already attained. Neither anticipated that the cause of the conflict might cease with, or even before, the conflict itself should cease. Each looked for an easier triumph and a result less fundamental and astounding. Yet," he continued, "if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." Just 4 days later, an assassin shot Lincoln, who died the next day. Andrew Johnson, the racist, pro-Southern vice president who took over, immediately reneged upon this promise of 40 acres, overturning Sherman's order. Many white Americans felt that black Americans should be grateful for their freedom, that the bloody Civil War had absolved them of any debt. The government confiscated the land from the few formerly enslaved families who had started to eke out a life away from the white whip and gave it back to the traders. And with that, the only real effort this nation ever made to compensate black Americans for 250 years of chattel slavery ended. We still live with the legacy of this choice. As the scholar Henry Louis Gates writes, try to imagine how profoundly different the history of race relations in the United States would have been had this policy been implemented and enforced, had the former slaves actually had access to the ownership of land, of property, if they had had a chance to be self-sufficient economically, to build, accrue, and pass on wealth. After all, one of the principal promises of America was the possibility of average people being able to own land and all that such ownership entailed. But the formerly enslaved did not give up, and neither have their descendants. During Reconstruction, black men serving in the U.S. Congress for the first time in history pushed for reparations in the form of federal aid for black schools. By the late 1800s, Reconstruction had been abandoned and violently concluded, and many formerly enslaved people, their bodies debilitated by decades of punishing manual labor for the enrichment of others, by poor nutrition and by lack of health care, were struggling in poverty, often without even enough money to bury their dead. A woman named Callie House, herself born into slavery, widowed in adulthood, and working as a washerwoman in Tennessee, began organizing freed people in the early 1900s under the National Ex-Slave Mutual Relief, Bounty, and Pension Association. Through this grassroots association, House organized tens of thousands of formerly enslaved people to push Congress to pass a bill to provide slave pensions, just as the federal government paid pensions to Union soldiers. After years of organizing failed to pay off with Congress, in 1915, House took an extraordinary step for a Black, formerly enslaved woman living in the Jim Crow South. She retained Cornelius Jones, one of a tiny number of Black lawyers practicing in Washington, D.C., and sued the federal government for reparations. In the suit, Jones argued that the U.S. Treasury owed Black Americans 68,073,388.99 for the taxes it had collected between 1862 and 1868 on the cotton enslaved people had grown. The federal government had identified the cotton and could trace it, and the suit argued that this tax money should be paid in the form of pensions for those who, against their will, had grown, picked, and processed it. The audacity of a Black woman demanding payment for her stolen labor and the stolen labor of millions of others, even if it would come directly from proceeds of the cotton they'd picked, brought down the full wrath of one of the most powerful governments in the world. The Treasury Department, under President Woodrow Wilson, first issued a press release insisting the United States owed nothing and that formerly enslaved people, if they had a claim at all, should seek reparations from their masters. A federal court then rejected the claim, citing government immunity, which says that the government must consent to being sued, and the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the decision. Not content with crushing the lawsuit, the government went after both Jones and House, accusing them of mail fraud for soliciting funds from formerly enslaved people to help the effort with promises that reparations were coming. The same government that refused to give freed people a dime of financial assistance for their enslavement accused those trying to get them aid of going through the country collecting hard-earned money from poor Negroes. Newspaper coverage perpetuated the basest stereotypes of people who'd spent a significant part of their lives working for free for the benefit of white people. The members of the race have been prone from time immemorial to strive to get something for nothing, an article in the Memphis Commercial Appeal announced. The federal government never produced any real evidence that showed that House had defrauded anyone, according to the historian Mary Frances Berry in her book, My Face is Black as True. But it did not matter. Jones, a respected and well-connected civil rights attorney, was not convicted. House, a poor Black woman, was convicted and then sentenced to prison, where she served a year. Mrs. House lacked Jones's status of Black male respectability, Berry writes. Mrs. House was just a Black woman with the audacity and no money to stand firmly on claims of citizenship rights for herself and freed men and women. Black Americans would never give up their quest for reparations, for restitution and repayment for the centuries of stolen labor and robbed opportunities. The Black nationalist Marcus Garvey would call for reparations in the 1910s and for Black Americans to leave this country and resettle in a Black one. Like Callie House, Garvey found himself targeted by the federal government for mail fraud. He was imprisoned and then deported. In the 1950s, the activist Queen Mother Audley Moore launched a movement for reparations, appealing to the United Nations in 1957 and 1959. In 1968, activists formed the Republic of New Africa, which claimed that since the United States had reneged on its promise of 40 acres, Black Americans should be given territory in the southeastern United States to form their own Black nation. Malcolm X called for reparations in 1963. In 1987, Adjoa Iyatoro and Amare Obadele helped found the National Coalition for Reparations in America, known as NCOBRA. And in 2021, the last three survivors of the Tulsa race massacre, all centenarians, testified in Congress in support of a reparations bill for the survivors and their descendants, 100 years after the slaughter that destroyed the prosperous black neighborhood of Greenwood and killed hundreds, and some 20 years after a state commission recommended reparations that were never given. None of these efforts succeeded. To this day, the only Americans who have ever received government restitution for slavery were white enslavers in Washington, D.C., whom the federal government compensated after the Civil War for their loss of human property.